Okay, thanks very much for having me. Well, when I got the assignment, I thought, oh gosh, what do I know about insurances? And what came to my mind was, well, I've been to the Allianz Park at Palmeiras with some USP Sao Paulo colleagues. I've been to the Allianz Stadium at Juventus with some Bocconi colleagues. So that expertise, of course, would have helped me for our paper one, but not for the insurance accounting paper. I do have an own class, master level class at Mannheim called Accounting for Financial Instruments and Institutions, where we do cover the whole third textbook of the EY International Gap Guide, except IFRS 17 insurance accounting, which we scope out of the class focus. Now, is it me? When we look at our academic profession, there's not much either. The study quotes three academic pieces on insurance contracts in accounting, all of the three unpublished and effectively 10 to 15 years old. Now, when you ask the key authority these days, so when you carefully prompt engineer GPT using the deep research option, the outcome is, oh, I did not locate many studies. In fact, there were zero. And he said, well, that in itself is an interesting gap for future research. So then what do the standard setters know? Well, to be honest, it took them 40 years to come up with the standards. We started in the 90s. The IASC couldn't come to grips. The IASB published IFRS 4, likely in a rush, shortly before the European adoption in 2005. It took another 10 years for until 2017, and then another 6 years to become effective after postponement. So all in all, I think we can all agree that it's a really complex accounting issue. So first, we all have to applaud the authors for having taken this complex accounting area and issue onwards. Now, when I evaluate the paper, it's very nicely written. It's also a very modern data collection process, a mixture of GDP and manual verification. That's something I liked a lot. And it's also very carefully executed. Of course, Zoltan and his junior co-authors know the setting, know the data, so I have no concerns whatsoever about the quality there. Having said that, of course, you've seen it. It's a purely descriptive study. So on the pro side, you can say this is the type of evidence the ISB always likes to see. So for example, at IAAR, we have this informing the ISB project, which is now likely to be in round 9. And I've been a participant and a faculty member of the program, and that's the type of evidence the ISB often seeks. So that's the positive side. As an academic, of course, we could say how ambitious is the project. It's entirely descriptive, so it just lets the data speak. So as a discussant, there's also, let's say, only I don't have the big smoking gun now to discuss the paper, but I can just suggest a small little incremental contributions which may help frame the paper into the literature. So a couple of comments. My first comment are that analyzing transition disclosures may not be as unique as claimed. Yeah. So for example, in this IFRS literature survey we did for financials and trends in the past, we have an own subchapter on studies which specifically exploit those transition IFRS 1 types of disclosures. And in bold, I've just bolded four of them, so I think it would be fair to also quote and reference to that literature, especially kind of the first, meaning Hu's RAS study in 2007. So kind of acknowledge the contributions. Then what I found interesting that you supposedly have two data points, like the 1st of January 2022 and the 31st of December, because usually those studies have only one data point. Yeah, so making this kind of distinction clear would be a nice addition. Then second, of course, we know from the literature that transition periods are specific and have specific incentives in themselves. So first of all, we know that there's so-called transition smoothing, which means that companies anticipate what the effects of the new accounting standards will be and manage the transition process to smooth out the fluctuations. They also may adjust in anticipation of a future disclosure kind of the economic activities up front. For example, the Fichte, Hitz and Lehmann paper running into the CSRD, they show that firms already in periods prior to the CSRD were increasing their CSRD activities so that when the big bang comes, they look nice. The second thing is that those transition options, which usually come with a new standard, and we have a number of transition options now with IFRS 17, they produce their own specific transition incentives. And a study I cover in my PhD class for a long time is the BDA and Weber in JAR, which looks at SFAS 142 adoption at the time and whether adopters, when they were required to do impairment testing, whether they took an impairment at the transition period, and in that case, the accounting effect would be so-called below the line in the income statement, or if they kind of gambled and waited and then took an impairment later, but then, you know, above the line and within net income. So all in all, we do know that transition periods are specific and there are specific transition options in IFRS 17. So it would be nice to learn a little bit more what type of specific transition incentives you could have in mind. Then the next things are just about the writing. The first is the tension. When you really read the paper, it's written very much kind of pro-IFRS Foundation, which may have been a strategic choice running into the conference. But you wonder, where's the tension? So why 40 years of developing the standard? It reads very smooth. You know, it's a very smooth process. It's a nice new standard. We have good new evidence. So you wonder, why did it take so long? What about those political debates? So I was wondering whether you could also speak to some of the critics' arguments in these debates. Then, from a conceptual underpinning point of view, obviously a theory part, which we often, you know, love as academics, is missing in there. I would suggest the Basshott and Stubben, a paper which kind of also looks at accounting mismatches in the own credit risk context. You know that paper, and they apply the Mertle model to nicely, in a theoretical framework, illustrate kind of the portfolio nature of financial assets and liabilities, and how changes in market conditions would, depending on the measurement basis, would affect those things. Then a little bit more help for the reader on insurance accounting. Maybe you could add as an appendix a nice graph or something almost like a teaching slide illustrating that, because even I struggle to understand, even I, because I teach financial instruments in the classroom. So it's this is kind of a tough thing for the, let's say, the regular academics. Then the title. I love the title on the one hand because it sounds sexy, making sense of, but to be honest, do we really make sense of? I think it's more kind of documenting the transition effects. The making sense of part is more limited, I have to say. Yeah. Then finally, the economics and the interpretation. When it comes to the economics part, you have a little bit something about economics at the back end. There, of course, we are on less solid ground because this is the test. There are quite limited, 1 year, stock return window, 1 year, etc. pp. So thus, interpretations as to whether the standard works as intended is, of course, premature and should be backed by more evidence. And I have some suggestions here about exploiting some interest rate exposures from the regulatory the Solvency II filings, for example, but I'm sure that you will have good ideas how to further extend in follow-up studies. So overall, I learned a lot from the study. For sure, as a community, we need to do more on insurance accounting, and for myself, the takeaway was less time in the Stocker Stadium, but more time on insurance accounting. Thanks.